If you all stand, we'll read the last five verses of the Old Testament in the King James Bible. Starting in verse 2 of chapter 4, "But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." You may be seated, except for Mark, who will come up here and preach this sermon. I'm very anxious to hear it.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today's message dovetails with Pastor Elmore's message last week entitled Murderers, and comes from a series I did several years ago called Why We Hate Jews. And let me tell you, nothing I have written has gotten more vitriolic response from Jews and Judeo-Christians than this one. And I think most of them probably just read the title and that's it. You know, they fly off the handle. But I think it's due to the fact that Jewish ritual murder is indelibly a part of the historical record, as much as they would like to see it disappear down a memory hole. I mentioned to Jim last Sunday that Martin Luther wrote a book called The Jews and Their Lies. And I brought it for you today, Jim. But something Martin Luther said is relevant to today's message. From his book, The Jews and Their Lies, quote, "They stabbed and pierced the body of the young boy, Simon of Trent. They have also murdered other children. The sun never did shine on a more bloodthirsty and revengeful people as they who imagine themselves to be the people of God and who desire to and think they must murder and crush the heathen. Jesus Christ, the almighty preacher from Nazareth, spoke to the Jews, 'Ye are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning.'" It's not so much the perverse nature of Jewry as much as its diabolical character that internationally threatens the entire planet. In the preface to the book, The World Significance of the Russian Revolution, Jewish writer Oscar Levy said, "There is scarcely an event in modern Europe that cannot be traced back to the Jews. We Jews today are nothing else but the world's seducers, its destroyers, its revolutionaries," end quote. One of the hallmarks of the Jewish religion and its people, according to the Apostle Paul, was that they killed the Lord Jesus and the prophets and have persecuted us, and they please not God. and are contrary to all men. A very common thread interwoven throughout the Talmud is stated by Rabbi Simon ben Yohai in the Jewish Encyclopedia, in which he says, "The best among the Gentiles deserves to be killed." Hosea 4:6 says, "My people," meaning white Christian Israelites, "my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge." We just mentioned Oscar Levy bragging about being the world's destroyers. Jews want us destroyed. And you know what? Our people don't know squat about Jews. Baal worship in American churches keeps our people spiritually anesthetized in order to further Jewish aims and ambitions. As it is written in the Talmud, "For thy sake, for the sake of Christ, we are killed all the day long. We are accounted as sheep for slaughter." Romans 8:36. This comes from an Old Testament Psalms. Psalms 42:22, which the Jews have bastardized in their Talmud to mean the murder of Christians has been sanctioned by God, which says in their Talmud, "There is a law concerning the slaughter of foreigners who are the same as beasts, the ones who do not follow the Jewish religious law have to be offered to God as a sacrifice." Now, throughout today's message, like the one I just read, I have citations, the sources, but I'm not going to read those because they're too lengthy and I can't pronounce half of them. But they will be included in the text, which can be found at our website. This law that I just read commands Jews to butcher non-Jews. The Greek historian Herodotus wrote about the Jewish cult sacrificing humans to their devil god Moloch. When Christ said your father was a murderer from the beginning, he may have been referencing these Jews to their god Moloch. The ancient Canaanites sacrificed their children in a type of, from what I've read, a giant frying pan to the god Moloch. And the Israelites started imitating them. Today, white people who consult the Jewish God Planned Parenthood sacrifice their children to Jewish abortionists, which is in essence a modern sanitized version of Moloch. In the protocols of the Urn of Elders of Zion, a secret document exposing the Jewish conspiracy, protocol number 11 states, "The Goyim," that's a derogatory term for white Christians, "are a flock of sheep, and we are their wolves." And as you know, what happens when wolves get a hold of the flock? Well, I think Gunn mentioned that very fact last week. Wolves in sheep's clothing. And here, they admit it in their own book. The Talmud teaches that wherever it is possible, a Jew should kill Christians and do so without mercy. Quote, "The life of a goy and all his physical powers belong to a Jew." Even Christians who read the Jews' filthy Talmud are slated for death. Rabbi Jochanan says, "A goy who pries into the law is guilty of death." The people of the earth, non-Jews, are idolaters, and it has been written about them, let them be wiped off the face of the earth. Now, these rabbinic writings are not isolated aberrations, but rather they are the definitive norm of Jewish thought. The homicidal tendency is cultured bloodlust in a petri dish from cradle to grave. Jews are taught from childhood the fundamental justifications for taking of innocent life. Their deviant theology is clearly reflected in the immoral pathology of Talmudic exhortations that thou shalt kill. That's why there's no comparison to Jewish law and God's law of the Christian Bible when dealing with the subject of taking life. For example, murder committed by a white Christian is punishable. Whereas if a Jew murders a white Christian or any other non-Jew, there is no death penalty, according to the Talmud. If a Jew accidentally kills another Jew when his intent was to kill a goyim, he is not criminally liable. The American public has been inundated with Jewish propaganda touting the brotherhood of Jews and Christians. However, the following passages betray any such association. Quote, the Jews are human beings, but the nations of the world are not human beings, but beasts. Quote, it is permitted to kill a Jewish denunciator everywhere. It is permitted to kill him before he denounces. Quote, an Orthodox Jew is not bound to observe principles of morality towards people of other tribes. He may act contrary to morality if profitable to himself or to Jews in general. Quote, to communicate anything to a goyim about our religious relations would be equal to killing of all Jews. For if the goyim knew what we teach about them, they would kill us openly. Quote, it is the law to kill anyone who denies the Torah. The Christians belong to the denying ones of the Torah. Quote, Christian birth rate must be diminished materially. Quote, Jews are not to prevent the death of a Christian. Quote, do not save Christians in danger of death. Jews are instructed to let them die. Quote, even the best of the goyim, meaning Christians, should be killed. Quote, if a Jew kills a Christian, he commits no sin. Quote, extermination of Christians is necessary. Quote, a Jew is innocent of murder if the intent was to kill a Christian. Quote, Christians who are not Jews' enemies must also die. Are you beginning to see why some white Christians used to talk about the Jewish question or the Jewish problem? The question was and is, what do we do about the construct of Jewish genocide against our race? Whenever the criminality of the Talmud was revealed in all its horror, it was ordered burned, expunged, or censored. It was burned at the stake in nearly every century from the 11th to the 18th in Italy, in France, Germany, Spain, and many other countries. At one time or another, the Jews have been expelled from every country in Europe. Entire Jewish populations have been purged. Just to give you a thumbnail chronology of real history, not fake, not counterfeit history. France was one of the first European nations which forced the deportations of Jews in 1182 AD. England in 1290. France again in 1306 and 1322. Hungary in 1360. Belgium in 1370. Austria in 1420. Bavaria in 1442. The Netherlands in 1444. Poland in 1483. Excuse me. Spain in 1492. Italy in 1492. Lithuania in 1495. Portugal in 1496. Prussia in 1510. Italy in 1540. Prague in 1541 and 1557, the Papal States in 1569, Hamburg in 1649, Vienna in 1669, Slovakia in 1744, Moscow in 1891. This is just the short list to impress upon you the gravity of wholesale rejection against Jews. The great repulsion has put Jews under worldwide suspicion, and for a good reason. The suspicion under which Jews are held is murder. It's not ordinary murder, but rather systematic murder that has a special name, called Jewish ritual murder. The accusation is immediately raised, regardless of time or location, where a corpse bears the conspicuous signs of Jewish ritual murder. The accusation from a gamut of nations has always been leveled against Jews and no one else, because of the trademark of the crime practiced against its victims. There are approximately 131 documented ritual murders committed by Jews. How many thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, have remained undiscovered is anybody's guess. What today's white Christians must not close their minds to is that the sordid history of the Jewish people is a continuum of mass murders and a lust for blood. What exactly is the ritual? And why is it part of the Jewish religion? Joseph Kastein, an official historian of Jewry, has stated that Jews believe blood is the seat of the soul, in contradistinction to the Christian view that the heart or one's spirit determines our soul or personality. Jews believe that by drinking the blood of a Christian victim who was perfect in every way, the Jews could overcome their physical shortcomings and become as powerful as the intelligent, civilized beings among whom they had formed their parasitic communities. The strange parallels can be traced back to the social pathologies of ancient Babylonian Baal worship and permutations found in the pagan practice of cannibalism. Secret occult societies have followed the lead of satanic instruction found in the Jewish Kabbalah. The Jews are charged with enticing white Christian children, and at times adults, into the synagogue or into more secret places for sacrificial slaughter. The victim is tied down, stripped, and pierced with sharp ritual knives in the identical places where the body of Christ was inflicted. As the blood is drained in the cups, the Jewish leaders drink the blood, calling down curses upon Christ and on all non-Jewish people. Only by performing this rite do they believe that they can continue to survive and prosper within the host nation. The Jews are charged with mixing this blood into their unleavened bread and using it to practice superstitious magic. The Jews are charged with torturing their victims, bleeding them white, crowning them with thorns, beating and stabbing them in a complete reenactment of the crucifixion. All Jews, unless they are mentally retarded, are aware of the blood ritual and its importance to Jewish culture. However, only the most influential leaders, rabbis, and rich Jews are allowed to participate in the ceremony. Ordinary Jews are forbidden because the criminal practice is fraught with security risk for the entire Jewish community, as past history has proven. Most uprisings against Jews during the last 2,000 years have developed from the discovery of this syndicated and institutionalized crime. There's a trickle-down application for those Jews who do not participate in the actual crime scenario. The ritual blood is used in other ways, by drying it for use in weddings, funerals, circumcisions, pregnancies, and older Jews believing that they can become younger by ingesting it. The remainder of the blood is preserved with the greatest of care by the local rabbis and sold in small bottles as certified Christian blood. Catholic scholar James E. Bulger states that the drinking of blood is a black magic ritual which enables the Jewish rabbis to predict the future. During the Jewish Passover, a Jewish father will mock the Christian communion by pouring a few drops of ritualized blood into a glass of wine and sprinkling the dinner table, saying, "We beg God to send down the 10 plagues upon the enemies of the Jewish religion." And after they wine and dine, he says, "Thus, like the child whose blood has been mixed in the bread and wine, may all Goyim burn in hell." Make no mistake about it. Jewish ritual murder is still going on today, and all levels of government do nothing because they are up to their necks in whitewash and cover-up. Those who know what's going on keep their mouths shut and receive their 30 pieces of silver. Why would Jews stop now in this day and age when they're on a roll? Ex-Congressman Paul Finley wrote a book called They Dare to Speak Out, which describes those officials in government who do not take the bribe and whose careers are virtually destroyed for speaking out against the Jew. Probably the best literary expose of Jewish ritual murder is by British author Arnold Leese in his book by the same name. And in this book is documented the most well-known case, which Martin Luther alluded to earlier in this message, Simon of Trent, which I would like to share with you today, because it is compelling and damning of the Jews and their perpetual duplicity of this ongoing crime against mankind. In 1475, a 3-year-old boy named Simon disappeared in the Italian town of Trent. The circumstances were such that suspicion fell upon the Jews. Hoping to avert the suspicion, they themselves found the child's body in a conduit where they afterwards confessed to having thrown it. Examination of the body, however, revealed that the boy had not been drowned. There were strange wounds on the body, a circumcision and crucifixion. About 7 Jews were arrested. They were tortured and confessed that the boy had been ritually murdered for the purpose of obtaining Christian blood to mix with their ceremonial unleavened bread. These confessions were made separately and agreed in all essential details. The Jews were tried and were ultimately executed. The officer in charge of the investigation of the crime had before him a converted Jew who described how his father told him that Jews of his town had killed a child at Passover to get the blood of which they partook in wine and cakes. No one has ever dared to try and deny the historical events of this case. Only the Jews invent reasons why it was not ritual murder. But there's no escape from the opposite conclusion. In 1759, in answer to a Jewish appeal from Poland, the Inquisition sent Cardinal Ganganelli, who later became Pope Clement XIV, to investigate and report on the whole subject, with particular reference to the many cases being reported in Poland. Although this man went out with a biased mind in favor of the Jews, in his report he says, "With my weak faculties, I endeavored to demonstrate the non-existence of the crime which was imputed to the Jewish nation in Poland." Hardly the spirit in which to enter upon such an investigation. He actually says of this Trent case, "I admit then as true the fact of the blessed Simon, a boy of 3 years old, killed by the Jews in Trent in the year 1475 in hatred of the faith of Jesus Christ. For the celebrated Flaminio Carneo, a Venetian senator, in his work on the cult of the child of Saint Simon of Trent, disposes of all doubts raised by the above-mentioned critics." The Jews try to throw discredit on the judges who condemned the Jewish murderers by quoting Pope Sixtus IV, who refused to sanction the cult of St. Simon. But the reason for this was that the cult was not then authorized by Rome, but was a popular movement without authority and contrary to church discipline. This same pope later expressed his approval of the verdict on the Jews in 1478. We have not only the testimony as to the correctitude of the proceedings from Sixtus IV, but also that of several other popes, such as Sixtus V, who regularized the popular cult of Saint Simon by ratifying it in 1588, as cited by Benedict XIV of his On the Canonization of Saints, also by this same Pope Benedict XIV in his bull of 1755, in which he confirms Simon as a saint, a fact omitted from the arguments that the advocate for the Jews, a man by the name of Strack, Gregory VIII recognized Simon as a martyr and even visited the shrine, and as already stated, Clement XIV was obliged to recognize that it was a case of Jewish murder in hatred of Christianity. St. Simon's shrine is in the Church of St. Peter in Trent. Relics of him are still shown, among them the sacrificial knife. In short, ritual murder of St. Simon of Trent is supported by such evidence that those who doubt it are thereby condemning without reason high judicial and ecclesiastical authorities whose probity and intelligence there is not the slightest excuse to deny. A British friend of the Rothschild family pursued criminal prosecution of Arnold Leese for writing what I just quoted to you about this story. Not under the law of libel, but what amounted to a public mischief, rendering His Majesty's subjects of the Jewish faith liable to suspicion, affront, and boycott. The judge in the case, being a 31st degree Mason of the Scottish Rite, sentencing Leese to 6 months in prison. Public records establishing the truth of Jewish ritual murder throughout history was forbidden by the judge as a line of defense for Mr. Leese. We can't have the truth in this courtroom. If Jewish ritual murder were just an anomaly of history, an abnormal occurrence of religious extremists, then we could just write it off as some kind of macabre criminal activity that is done and over with. However, that is not good enough for the Jew. They can't just give it a rest. They have to pull all the stops at their disposal to expunge any memory of it ever happening, which to my estimation gives credence to the idea that Jews have this neurotic predisposition to stir things up that has just got the opposite effect of their desires for vindication. It's the same boomerang effect as their hysterical bleeding about the Holocaust that pushes beyond credibility or sympathy, as if no one else in the world ever suffered from programs of extermination, such as the Jewish Bolsheviks killing 20 million Russians. This is how Jews dealt with it back then and today. They persecute or kill the authors writing about it, or witnesses who are knowledgeable of the subject. They violently abuse lawyers and prosecutors pursuing cases of ritual murder. They disappear books on the subject, which are considered anti-Semitic, or more recently fall under hate crime laws. deliberate misrepresentation of authority history, bribery of witnesses and court officials, producing another corpse as a decoy for the real victim of ritual murder, false accusations against innocent people, refusal or threats, this is the big one I saved for last, refusal or threats to refuse loans to governments. All of the aforementioned practices have been documented, Jewish practices, to fight the charge of blood libel. From the influential Rothschilds to the Anti-Defamation League. They bemoan the exact indictment of killing Jesus Christ. But their predecessors declared, as if written in concrete, the admission for all time, recorded in Matthew 27:25, His blood shall be upon us and our children. The truth shall make us free from the Jews and their lies. In a bizarre twist of fate, much like Jewish writers Arthur Kessler and Norman Finkelstein, another Jewish scholar has embarrassed the Jewish establishment. Dr. Ariel Toaff, a professor at the Jewish University near Tel Aviv, the son of the rabbi of Rome, has written a monumental 3-volume work on Jewish life during the medieval age, reporting on this strange sequence of events. Another Jewish writer, who is controversial, Mr. Israel Shamir, explains the conflict between Dr. Toaff and Zionist henchmen. Shamir says, while studying his subject, he, Toaff, discovered that the medieval Ashkenazi Jewish communities of North Italy practiced a particularly horrible form of human sacrifice. Their wizards and adepts stole and crucified Christian babies, obtained their blood, and used it for magical rituals, evoking the spirit of vengeance against the hated Goyim. In particular, he dwelt on the case of St. Simon of Trent. This 2-year-old child from the Italian town of Trent was kidnapped by a few Ashkenazi Jews from his home on the eve of Passover, 1475. At night, the kidnappers murdered the child, drew his blood, pierced his flesh with needles, crucified him head down, calling out, "So may all Christians by land and sea perish." And thus they celebrated their Passover, an archaic ritual of outpouring blood and killing babies in the most literal form. The killers were apprehended, confessed, and were found guilty by the Bishop of Trent. Immediately the Jews took their protest to the Pope, and he had sent a bishop to investigate. He allegedly accepted a hefty bribe from the Jews and concluded that the child was murdered. Simon had been killed by Christians with the intent of ruining the Jews. However, in the 15th century, the Jews were influential, yeah. But all-powerful? No. They could not deal with the world like they did in 2002 after the massacre of Jenin by ordering everybody to buzz off. They had no American veto in the Security Council. They could not bomb Rome. And the word anti-Semitism was invented 400 years later. Now, mind you, I'm still quoting this Jewish professor. They were given a fair deal, which is much worse than preferred treatment. Pope Sixtus IV assembled a commission of six cardinals, chaired by the best legal mind of that time, for retrial. And this Supreme Court found the murderers guilty. Records of the trial have survived centuries and are still available in the Vatican. In 1965, the Roman Catholic Church entered a type of perestroika. These were the days of Vatican II when the modernizers uprooted the foundations of tradition, hoping to update the faith and to fit it into the new Jewish-friendly narrative of modernity. In plain prose, the bishops wanted to be loved by the liberal press. The ever-watchful Jews used the opportunity and pushed the bishops to decommission St. Simon of Trent. They were happy to oblige. Already in bizarre ritual, the church leaders had found the Jews free from guilt for the crucifixion of Christ, while admitting the church's guilt for the persecution of Jews. And the crucifixion of an Italian baby was a small matter compared with this reversal. In a hasty decision, the bishops ruled that the confessions of the killers were unacceptable because they were obtained under torture, and thus the accused were innocent, while the young martyr was removed and dumped in a secret place to avoid a resumption of pilgrimages. Now we come back to Dr. Ariel Towach. While going through the papers of the trial, he made a staggering discovery. Instead of being dictated by the zealous investigators under torture, the confessions of the killers contained material totally unknown to the Italian churchmen or police. The killers belonged to the small and withdrawn Ashkenazi community who practiced their own rites, quite different from those used by the native Italian Jews. These rites were faithfully reproduced in their confessions, though they were not known to the crime squad of their day. These liturgical formulas in Hebrew, more likely Yiddish, with a strong anti-Christian tone, cannot be projections of the judges who could not know these prayers, which didn't even belong to the Italian rites, but to the Ashkenazi tradition. Towach wrote, a confession is of value only if it contains some true and verifiable details of the crime that the police did not know of. This iron rule of criminal investigation was observed in the Trent trials. This discovery has the potential to shake, shock, and reshape the church. The noble, learned rabbi, Dr. Towach, brought back St. Simon, the double victim of the 15th century vengeance of 20th century perestroika. This called for repentance of the Vatican doctors who forgot the murdered child while looking for friendship with important American Jews. But they still do not admit their grave error. Monsignor Eugenio Roger, a church historian who in the 1960s misled the investigation into St. Simon's case, said that the confessions were completely unreliable, for the judges used horrible tortures. This was an anti-Zionist and hence anti-Semitic remark. being that the confessions were completely unreliable. For the judges used horrible tortures. This was an anti-Zionist and hence anti-Semitic remark, for rejection of the confessions obtained under torture would let all the Palestinian prisoners out of Jewish jails. This was an anti-American remark, for the U.S. recognizes the value of torture and practices it in Guantanamo and elsewhere. This was a Holocaust denier remark, for thus they invalidate the Nuremberg trials. The renowned Jewish-American lawyer and adept of torture, Alan Dershowitz, could have argued against Roger, but somehow he did not. I wouldn't want to be in Toaff's shoes answering for this to historians who have seriously documented this case, said Roger to USA Today. Toaff's shoes are vastly preferable to those of Roger, who will have to answer for slighting the saint in heaven. Moreover, this saint, this Simon of Trent crime, was not an exception. Toaff discovered many cases of such bloody sacrifices connected with the mutilation of children, outpouring of blood, and its baking in matzo or unleavened bread, spanning 500 years of European history. Blood, this magic drink, was popular medicine of the time and of any time. Herod tried to keep young by bathing in the blood of babies. Alchemists tried using blood to turn lead into gold. Jewish wizards meddled in magic and used it as much as anybody. There was a thriving market in such delicacies as blood, powder made of blood, and bloody matzo. Jewish vendors sold it accompanied with rabbinic letters of authorization. The highest value was blood of a goy katan, which means a Gentile child. Such blood sacrifices were instinctive, visceral, virulent actions and reactions in which innocent and unknowing children became victims of the love of God and of vengeance, Toaff wrote in the book's preface. He said their blood bathed the altars of a God who, it was believed, needed to be guided, sometimes impatiently pushed, to protect and to punish. Wow! Don't you just love it when Jews make our case for us? Jews have the power to conceal their crimes, as their media-controlled image portrays themselves as the eternal victim. The Jewish reaction to what they call the blood libel charge has always been via being persecuted. With a straight face, they maintain that down through the millenniums of history, there has been a humongous conspiracy to frame them. According to this theory, in all the European nations mentioned earlier, and in places as far apart as Montreal and Argentina, there exists one big, long, continuous plot to murder white children at certain times of the year, drain them of blood, and then plant the bodies on Jewish premises so they get caught. That's one heck of a conspiracy, folks. But are we to believe that our ancestors were just anti-Semitic fools who periodically plotted to persecute Jews? If the real-life kid killers were non-Jews, would they allow the real killers to go free because they wanted a Jewish scapegoat? Why, time after time, did the ritual murders cease after the Jewish killers were prosecuted and executed or driven from the land? In the United States, perhaps the most famous victim of Jewish ritual murder was the son of Charles Lindbergh on March 1st, 1932, during the time of the Jewish annual Feast of Purim. Lindbergh's father, a U.S. congressman, had published a scathing indictment against the Warburg Jewish bankers' passage of the Federal Reserve Act, in which federal agents confiscated and burned. After Charles became a national hero from his solo flight across the Atlantic and following in his father's footsteps to warn the American public about the evil ambitions of Jewry to start World War II against Germany, his little boy was slain as a warning to back off. Eustace Mullins, in his book, New History of the Jews, said, in the United States, Jews have been able to practice ritual murder of Gentile children with impunity because they control the press and because they hold so many high public officials. It has been estimated by a leading police official that 4,000 children disappear in the U.S. each year. There is no question that the majority of them are victims of Jewish ritual murder. So prevalent has the custom become in this country that Jews are able to ship large quantities of the children's blood to Israel for use in their ceremonies there. One of the problems of the Jewish homeland in Israel has been a shortage of Christian children who can be used in the ritual ceremony. And the United States, which has also furnished most of the money to Israel, has also provided much of the required children's blood. How many Christians are aware of the appalling estimate of 100,000 children missing each year? Thousands are murdered with the blood drained from their little bodies. The Jewish people are entirely capable and complicit in committing this dastardly deed. The immense weight of historical evidence conclusively points to the repetitive cycle and psyche of murder in the Jewish soul for Jesus Christ and everything Christian. How many of the innocent youngsters you see on milk cartons have fallen prey to the ceremonial knives of rabbis and lie buried in secret graves or are ground up into dog food in some Jewish-owned processing plant? This all may sound unthinkable and outlandishly far-fetched to the cognitive dissonant mind that has been conditioned to eagerly accept the mythos of 6 million gas bag Jews turning into ash after 60 years of Pavlovian movies, books, and TV. It would be quite another story if these medias were not owned and or controlled by Jews. You would be hearing about the greatest murder plot against humanity in the history of the world, Jewish ritual murder. The Jew cannot escape what it has taken upon itself. Every Jew enjoys their station in life because of their lust for blood. Their benefactors are crucifiers and mass murderers. At one time, you could read who was the biggest mass murderer in history, in mankind, in the Guinness Book of World Records. Somebody got to him. That's no longer a category. If it were, you would read about Lazar Kaganovich, Stalin's Jew, who planned and implemented the extermination of 20 million Russians and Ukrainian peasants. Within the first 5 years of Jewish rule in the Soviet Union, the bloodstained terror estimated 6,000 teachers, 8,000 medical doctors, 50,000 army officers, 260,000 soldiers, 150,000 police, 12,800 civil servants, 355,000 of the upper class, 192,000 middle class workers, and 815,000 peasants. Between the years of 1921 and 22, over 5 million died of socially engineered starvation. In 1933, the Archbishop of Canterbury reported 6 million victims of famine. Alexander Solzhenitsyn cited the research of the exiled Soviet statistician I.A. Kurganova, who had access to secret government figures, as estimating that the number of people killed by the Soviet secret police between the revolution and 1959 totaled at least 66 million souls. This is the actual system of Talmudic bloodshed and death carried out by hysterical and neurotic Jews of the worst sort of criminal megalomania imaginable, who would have it copied in every country and among every people with the same terror insofar as they might find the potential to do so. There is an underworld in the world of organized crime that a famous New York prosecutor nicknamed Murder Incorporated on September 11th. Not 2001, 1931. At this point in time, a paradigm shift occurred in the world of crime as the old guard greaser Sicilian mobsters were eclipsed by a newly rising gangster, many of whom were non-Italian, and lethally streamlined for a new era of an American criminal corporation. Richard Kelly Hoskins calls it the International Trade Cartel. Others call it communism, Zionism, the New World Order, the global economy, or the United Nations. I prefer to call it the satanic antichrist of world Jewry. The transformation of ultra depredations and moral trauma committed at the highest levels of our society makes it nearly impossible to discern the grotesque structure that has taken shape in the form of a superbly efficient assassination machine. It's just not called the American Jewish Crime Corporation or registered with the New York Stock Exchange because it has absorbed the major players of the professional business world into their insatiable grab for power. It is the ethnic identity of these habitual terrorists that is relevant to our wake-up call for survival. We must realize that the political process of a constitutional republic was profoundly compromised by the Jewish mafia engineering the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932. Meyer Lansky and other criminal Jewish crime lord decided who the president of the United States would be then and ever since. The murder of John F. Kennedy, his brother Robert, and his son John Jr. is not an unsolved mystery in light of mounting evidence towards the empire of Jewish criminals. Hollywood has carefully perpetuated the facade of Dago stereotypes like The Godfather in all the gangster genre movies, while the real mob bosses have remained hidden. John Gotti was a major player, betrayed by his own brotherhood, and a perfect caller for law enforcement propaganda. Whether the cops or prosecutors bust the real culprits, that is, the Jews, you can count on the shrill whiner prosecutors screaming anti-Semitism, who wrap themselves in the camouflage of religion. Ronald Reagan was given a warning shot after publicly talking about abolishing the Jewish IRS. Not wanting to end up like JFK, Reagan appointed U.S. Federal Judge Irving Kaufman to head his new crime commission to crack down on organized crime. Kaufman was secretly a high-level member of the Anti-Defamation League, a vicious hidden foe of America and Christianity. After 2.5 years, this Jew's great revelation was denouncing new criminal networks emerging in the U.S. from Italian, Japanese, Chinese, Mexican organizations. Of course, this Jew never once mentioned the Mishpuka, which means family. That is the Jewish crime family, the most secret, deadly, powerful, organized crime family in the world, and the only one dedicated to the total destruction of white Christian America. Let me tell you something about this Mishpuka. It's not anything new. Just a well-concealed cult usurping peaceful governments and their people while posing as philanthropists and do-gooders. The word Mishpuka must become recognized by all law enforcement agencies as much as the word mafia, if Americans are to ever fully understand who their real enemy is, not counterfeit enemies. The hierarchy and brains of the Mishpuka stem from the ADL, B'nai B'rith, from which all orders and directives come. Their financial headquarters and source of great wealth is the Federal Reserve System. Their muscle is found in the overwhelming number of black robes of state and federal judiciaries, practicing Babylonian, admiralty, and Talmudic case law. The Mishpuka have been around for over 1,000 years and possess millions of tons of gold, gems, bonds, and securities from looting family fortunes, such as the Tsar of Russia. The Mishpukas slaughtered the Russian Tsar and his entire royal family and stole one of the world's greatest estates. Their monstrously huge treasure stash is hidden in the secret Dimona nuclear factory in Israel's Negev desert, protected by thousands of ICBMs capable of hitting white Christian nations around the world. No one is going to be inspecting this location anytime soon. Top-ranking Mishpuka Shimon Peres has boldly threatened the entire world by saying, "We will take all of you with us." In 1977, U.S. Congressman Henry Gonzalez of Texas disgustingly explained that he had resigned the chairmanship of the House Committee to Investigate Assassinations, quote, because vast and powerful forces, including the country's most sophisticated crime element, won't stand for it. The criminal element is all-pervasive, loaded with nothing but money, and in many ways more potent than the government itself. End quote. Of course, he couldn't have been alluding to anybody other than the Jews. There is no other religious literature in the world that advocates such gratuitous wholesale murder as does the Jewish Talmud. Kill the goyim by any means possible. Take the life of the demon Christians and kill them. Then you will please the Queen of Heaven, who will be kind to you as though you had burned a sacrifice. This matriarchal god, the mother of harlots, is Babylonian, as is the Talmud, the abominations of the earth. Revelation 17:5 speaks of mystery Babylon the Great, which is a final culmination of all previous beast empires, drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. A mystery in Scripture is a previously hidden truth, now divinely revealed, but in which a supernatural element still remains despite the revelation. There is a reckoning coming, a fulfillment of prophecy between the children of those who have departed from God and the children of those who have remained with God. It's the war of Obadiah between Christians and Jews. And the house of Jacob shall be fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken it. You might say we owe them a Holocaust. We've been paying their bills for the last 50 years, and at some point, we're finally going to get what we paid for. And I will close on that happy note with the last few verses, which Pastor Elmore read from the beginning, because I think it leaves us with a signpost of hope and victory. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And ye shall go forth and grow up as the calves of a stall. And ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet. In the day that I shall do that, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember ye the law of Moses my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse.